this distinctive character like no one else I've come close to meeting or knowing. You know, that part sticks out with me. And it's, and look, if I criticize it all, it's out of love. It's the frustration of not necessarily for all these years I've known him to be able to get through on certain things. But, you know, I look back and it's like, that's a life lived. And who am I to judge? And it's like, you know, so he was sloppy. and there's just many times when I look back, he makes me laugh. Just being who he was. And that's in a good way. I'm not laughing at him. I'm really laughing with him at the ridiculousness of it all. But, you know, he didn't fit in. And to me, that was something that I think I admired in the music writers in general weren't generally conformists. That's what publicists were. And these were people that their opinion was supposed to matter, their voice was supposed to matter. And really looking at this art form, music, what they thought was supposed to matter.
In early May, author and critic Ed Warren died at his home in Austin. As word spread, his friends and fans shared their stories about Ed. This time, on the Plutopia podcast, four of his friends share their recollections, warts and all. Jonick Petoskey and Nate Wilcox join John and Scoop to share stories and opinions about their very complicated friend.
So welcome, everybody, to the latest edition of the Plutopia podcast. We're kind of sad today. We're here today to talk about a friend who has departed, the mortal coil. Our guests today with Scoop and I are Nate Wilcox, who was with Ed Ward, the co-host of Let It Roll podcast. And I guess he's the sole host and has been for a while. And then our friend Jonick Petoskey is joining us. Joe is an author based in Austin and knew Ed well. We all knew Ed pretty well and spent time with him, hung out with him. And we just thought we'd gather today and talk about Ed. We don't have a particular agenda or outline for our discussion, but we're just going to talk.
Well, I think we should have Jodek repeat what he was saying about glossing over someone who is departed. And I think that's important because we all have, I've got so many faults, I can't even count them. But Ed's perceived faults by some were character traits that we all have. So I just think we just need to remember all the parts of our friend.
No, Ed was, to me, when I look at him, try to step back and why even discuss this guy Ed Ward? Well, you know, I first knew him as a byline, as a music critic, a rock critic, a term that he hated. But rock criticism, music criticism, doing that whole discipline seriously started in the late 1960s. And Ed was one of those instigators of what was a whole different way of looking at music and approaching it in words. And where Ed could write narrative, I still look at him as the master critic, a breadth of knowledge of all kinds of music, unlike anyone I know. And very opinionated about all these things. He was a professional critic. And Ed's, if we talk about faults, Ed was a critic on stage and off the stage. He didn't know when to shut it off. So, you know, being the critic that he was, many perceived him, and not inaccurately, as acerbic, blathering, loud, bloviating, full of shit, and you know, all these things may have been applicable, but that's part of what being a critic's about. You're art and trying to you're listening to art and trying to interpret it for the masses. And when he started, that was really important. You start looking about how you know, bought whether it was a record or something at the shop, or I don't know what it would be, but it wasn't that. So I'm just saying that he, at this period of time when he started, all of a sudden music was something part of the culture. And it was this tool. It wasn't just something you danced to anymore. It became important. And Ed was one of these messengers of this. And to me, that importance can't be understated. I first met him reading him, as many people said. And then, of course, you know, is it wrong to meet your people that you like or admire their stuff? You know, is it wrong to meet your heroes? Ed wasn't a hero, but, you know, a lot of people get disappointed because they see the real person. And all I can say is, to meet Ed then, the person, Ed was a fucking trip. And that's one thing that's just really been, since his passing, and we hadn't talked for a long time. I was pissed at him. But he was so distinctive, such a character, and such to me, even though it was irritating, it was off-putting, it was antisocial, it was being an asshole, he was consistent of what he was and who he was all the way to the end. And to me, he tells the story of his life is the history of music criticism today. Most music criticism that I look at is reverted to nothing but being glorified publicity. And Ed came from a time when it was really important to call a spade, no matter what the consequences were. And Ed paid the price of those consequences sometimes.
Yeah, he got in a lot of trouble here in Austin, I know, when he started writing for the Statesman, and there was the whole Dump Ed Ward movement, which I hate to admit, I even sent a letter to the Statesman complaining about him one time, and I got a letter back from him, and he was not happy with me. In fact, I don't even know if he ever remembered this when we got to be friends, but he had made some, you remember Ellie Rucker's column on the Statesman, the advice column thing? And he sent a letter to Ellie Rucker saying that that he was trying to find like an ideal set of earplugs for the concerts you had to go to all the time. And I wrote a letter to the editor to the effect that, well, that kind of explains Ed Ward. You know, he's wearing earplugs to the concert.
Well, that's better than the proverbial letter, did Ed Ward go to the same concert I did? You know, which is always, that was kind of like the knee jerk shit. But, you know, good critics, Ed, you know, Lester Bangs, R. Meltzer, Chris Gow, Jeff Stokes, people like that. You read them not because you're necessarily going to listen to this piece of music, but it was just the way that they talked about music. And Ed was one of those that you really read him because he had interesting observations to make. And he saw music in a broad way. No matter where you were exploring, you could ask him about it. And he had a take that, you know, it wasn't like, hey, Ed, I discovered this music. If anything, one area that he didn't have a great skill set with was Texas Mexican music, which is kind of one of my fetishes. But otherwise, you know, he knew everything. And, you know, why he didn't know Texas Mexican music better, that was his chosen blind spot.
Yeah, it just wasn't to his taste, I think.
No, he learned German, he learned French, but he didn't learn Spanish.
You know, I wrote a review of Shiva's Headband in 1970 and sent it to Rolling Stone. And I got a constructive response back with some detail, and basically in that response it said that that I really didn't write enough about the music. I wrote a lot about the band but not about the music, and I really should have rewritten that thing and sent it back. But maybe 3 years ago I ran across that thing in some of my papers, that rejection letter I'd got, my first ever rejection letter. And it was signed by Ed. Wow. So Ed was the first person to send me a rejection letter.
Yeah. Well, that's the key to, you know, what Ed was all about is reading his reviews and just his articles, his books. You get a feeling for the guy's research and his knowledge, and you don't see that in a lot of music journalism. It's all about, you know, the band and the song and the whatever, but there's no background, and he was the king of background when it came to music.
Yeah, and the point about that that rejection letter I got was that it was it actually told me something. It was detailed. It was nice. It was not unpleasant at all. He was very nice to me, and it was completely constructive. And you know, that was really Ed. Ed was, as Joe Nick says, he's like the critic's critic, and he was critical of many things, but he and some people felt that he was kind of an asshole about it, but he was really most of the time trying to be constructive, I think.
I definitely think he was trying to be constructive, and a lot of people posted those notes of rejections letters they had gotten from him at Rolling Stone, or encouragement letters and acceptance letters that they had gotten. And it does seem like he was a very generous and constructive editor. But one thing I find interesting about Ed, you know, if you look at his peers, Grell Marcus, Lester Bangs, Chris Gow, Ed is a gifted narrative writer in a way I don't think any of those guys were. I think some of them, I think Chris Gow obviously has stuck with being a critic and kept up with the music over this whole time, which he's the only person I know of alive that's been monitoring popular music for 70 years and keeping up with all the latest stuff. But what Ed did quite early on was start focusing on stuff he really loved, which was 50s music, and he kept the flame alive for that for decades. You know, he wrote the first third of the official Rolling Stone history of rock and roll in the 80s, and my God, it's so much better than the rest of that book. You know, Ed is just such a great narrative, was such a great narrative writer. And I think when he focused on the era when he had been a fan and had that objective perspective of, I'm a fan, this is what I like, I'm going to get more into it, he was really great. And he recognized that it's really impossible to keep up with new music when you're getting a mountain of free records every week with all these expectations of, you know, I'm supposed to fluff this guy, this is the hot hype I need to push. And he just didn't play that game at all and opted out of that pretty early on. And then it comes back to the Statesman, you know, he was at Cream, and it comes back to the Statesman and just really goes to town. I've been going back through and looking at some of his Statesman reviews, and what a culture class. I mean, he comes to Bug Tussle where nobody has done this at all and just lets rip. And, you know, sometimes he missed the boat. I mean, I think he was pretty glaringly wrong about Stevie Ray Vaughan and pretty shitty about it. That's one of the few pieces I read where he was really
nasty.
Yeah, just nasty about it. And I understand, because like for Ed, I talked to Ed about that once, and he said he had flashbacks to the Memphis show when Johnny Winter played at the Memphis Blues Festival. And he saw Stevie Ray in that same way as this, you know, over-amplified newcomer who's doesn't know the blues tradition and is just exploiting and profiteering off of it. And, you know, I mean, he did what he did, and it was what it was. But I think there's a reason that he moved into celebrating the music of the 50s, and also then going on and moving on and being really into techno. He recognized these are the elements that go into a truly innovative scene, and he saw that in the acid house techno revolution in the late 80s and early 90s, and it always impressed me with he was way hipper to that stuff than I was, and that was the music of my generation.
Well, you mentioned his you know, the stack of records that people in our line of work at that time. I was music editor at Zodiac News Service, and I worked with Ed because Ed's dear departed Mercedes, which I don't think it ever ran really, but it was parked in front of his Sausalito home, and he found out I had a car, so we worked out a deal. I was his chauffeur to a lot of events in San Francisco, and he was my guide into becoming part of the San Francisco music scene. But I was transitioning from being a political writer So I was pretty clueless, and I probably still am. But Ed helped my music collection immensely because he introduced me to village music in Mill Valley, which is what was at the time was probably one of the greatest record stores out there.
The greatest record store in the world.
Yeah, I always felt that way. And there was a little secret among people in the business that got massive amounts of record albums, most of which are not even good as drink coasters. But if you took them, I guess it's okay to say it now, way after the fact, if you took them to Village Music, you could get a dollar credit that could be applied to good music that was always in stock there at Village Music. So I was able to clear out the mountain of useless vinyl, and Ed guided me. But I would pick out stuff, and he'd go, "You don't want that. That's horrible." It's like, "Oh, okay." And he would guide me to another bin and say, "This is what you need to be looking at." And he was always right, for me anyway, because it's stuff I really still like. And he was that way. But you don't want to invite him over for dinner, because God save you if it is not something that he approves of. You will get a review, and
you never had the guts to cook anything for
you. We kept
talking about inviting him for dinner and always talked ourselves out of it.
Well,
we invited him several times, numerous times. The last time was basically disinvited.
Well, Ed did an article on the Texans in the Bay Area, and he came over to my place in Oakland, and I had some of the people from KSAN and from Zodiac News over there, and I was fixing Tex-Mex, what I considered Tex-Mex, you know, enchiladas and nachos and various things like that. And I had some genuine Lone Star beer that I bought from Ed, of course. He brought over his own beer and sold it to me. And he did an article for New West Magazine, which was really nice. But boy, he went through, instead of concentrating on doing the interviews and stuff, he was in the kitchen watching us prepare the enchiladas. It's like, damn, man, sit down and relax. But he was that way about food, and I learned a lot about food from just talking to him.
He and Morthland were kind of like hot heat freaks.
Mm-hmm. They're
Junior Les Blanks. They couldn't eat food hot enough, and sometimes it would get a little over the top. But this took they were all about hole in the walls, and I thought about that then, in the 60s, by the mid 70s, hole in the wall Chinese joints in San Francisco were getting hard to find. You know, it was gentrifying pretty quick. And by hopping from there and coming to Austin, where all the hole in the walls were Mexican joints, he started a whole new exploration. And he was very proud early on. Joe King's on the road, and we came back. This must have been after our first long tour, but he was really proud to turn us on to a place he found on the east side in a house, and no one had heard about it. None of us had, because we'd been out of town. And he really liked showing people places like that. He was, and I think that's what I've heard a lot of stories about people coming to South by Southwest that way. He's a good ambassador. I was the flip in the sense that he already had a Texas fetish. He and Morthland both had Texas fetish. That beautiful picture of them in Rolling Stone, they're both wearing pearl snaps in San Francisco. Start thinking about that. So, you know, we all got along famously when we met one another. And I think mainly the interest on their end of me was where I was from and where I lived. So, you know, I met him in 75 and after a lot of correspondence back and forth, and saw him again in 75 at the Willie Nelson picnic. I met him out in San Francisco in like January of 75, and then in July in Austin, and several other times. You know, he'd come to Austin for events, and we did the Mothership Connection tour, except that was 77 or 78. We went on that junket together. But by then, you know, Ed was an established cat. So when I had been writing about, been working halftime at the Statesman, this intern who'd also at the Statesman, this guy that was writing for the Statesman that had worked for the Washington Post, somehow befriended me through Texas Monthly and got me to work there halftime. And then like 77, 78, I started working full-time at the Statesman as the music writer. That was specifically what I was doing, and doing a music column with Joe Froelich, who was a beat reporter. And we covered music all of a sudden. It was kind of a new thing, but there was traction. And in the fall of 79, I'm the smart ass and I know enough about the music business that I'm going to quit writing and manage Joe King Carrasco and the Crowns, the band my girlfriend's playing in. And on my way out the door, I recommended Ed for the job at the Statesman. And the Statesman wisely, you know, had seen this, this has got an audience here. This is something important and we should be stepping it up. So Ed was a prestigious national hire in that respect. And it was a real stretch, but you know, he's a guy with all these bylines and certainly Rolling Stone helped. So there's your culture clash. It was, he brought, you know, this is what he's supposed to do. He thought this is what he's supposed to do, but, and it was what he was, had been doing elsewhere on a national stage, but now he's supposed to do it for Smallville. And I look at, you know, he irritated Doug some, who just didn't like criticism and didn't take to any criticism. And it was as kind of a smart ass. And by through Doug, Alvin Crowe, the Western Swing Fiddler. But the reggae band The Lotions, here's a guy that's been in the room, smoked weed with, and written about Bob Marley. And here he is asked to judge mid-American reggae, where there may have been a black guy in the band, maybe. It's one of those situations. So it's like, you know, that Ed was a fish out of water, but at the same time, he did champion, he championed Standing Waves. I've been reminded a new wave band, which was managed by Roland Swenson. He was always very kind to the band I managed, Joe King. I didn't have a problem with what he wrote. I liked what he wrote. And I liked that he was kind of pissing people off, but you know, the t-shirts and the bumper stickers, you know, it's all one thing. It's what you're supposed to do and get a reaction. And he was, but I always, knowing at the core was this really softy puppy dog, it had to hurt. And, you know, I've been kind of doing a lot of reconstruction with his sister about his earlier life. And a lot of things have been not surprisingly consistent in his life. And one thing was, is she said he's been burning bridges his whole life. And I just think that he never found his way as a child until he found his way with words and the power of words in print and got the reactions that he did. And, you know, combining that with this insatiable knowledge and intelligence, you know, was he a genius? Was he on the spectrum? I don't know any of this stuff. I'm not smart enough to make those decisions, but or judgment calls. But what's real clear is he was an outlier. I mean, he was a fish out of water. He was a stranger in a strange land, and where he fit in, were in some of the oddest places. And the one world he fit in the most was this strange world of music criticism. And that's, you know, that's what he's going to be known as. I noticed the books are selling, the history books, History of Rock and Roll Parts 1 and 2. I looked on Amazon the other day and they're moving. I mean, it's not a Buddy Holly thing, but he's got a little bump, a posthumous bump. And as a historian, those words are going to be forever as long as there's an audience for them.
somebody really let him down there at the end. I mean, and you know, he talked about it being his publisher, and he talked about it being fresh air and so forth. But whatever it was, he wrote these two like great histories of rock and roll, and they just were not getting the attention they deserved. And I think that that really hurt him. I think he felt terrible about that, and certainly had a lot to say about it. But
I don't think those were reasonable expectations that he had. And I thought he was blue skying, you know, all these things are going to take care of all my troubles. And it's like, it don't work that way. And when I was doing Austin to ATX, he came to several events. And I was basically, you know, I know volume two was coming out. We talked a lot about, you know, here's some marketing people you can do and all that. And in the end, he left it up to the publicity department of a publisher in New York. And that ain't the way it works anymore. I don't think his expectations were honest towards the end. I mean, he was blue skying it. And you know, all of a sudden, Spain's going to take care of all his problems. Who do you know in Spain? Don Snowden. You've met him a few times. That's the reason you're moving to Spain. And I thought you couldn't get research materials in France. And, you know, it was the Pacific Northwest briefly. And the last was he was going to move to the Hudson Valley to Catskill, New York.
Yeah.
And work part-time in a record shop. And then maybe work part-time in a bookstore if they had one of those. But that one, towards the end, I was frustrated because I don't think he's being a reasonable human being. And it was at the expense of his craft.
Well, the thing about marketing the book, Nate, is kind of where you got involved, right? You were trying to help him with the podcast.
I mean, kind of. It was just sort of a spur of the moment thing when I went to the book signing, because I had, you know, I loved the 80s book that he'd written. And I had just gotten into that 40s and 50s R&B kind of in a serious way the last couple of years before he wrote his new book. So when I heard he was working on that, I was really excited. And we went to the book signing, and, you know, I had hung out with him at South by Southwest several years and really enjoyed hanging out with him. And I had been looking for a podcast to do that didn't have anything to do with combat sports, which is my day job. And there he was. And I just asked him if he wanted to do a podcast about the book. And he said, yeah. And then, you know, I was hoping that his NPR relationship was going to help the podcast, you know, but he got so, you know, and that kind of gave me a front row seat for his self-inflicted troubles. And even talking to him about the way he conceived the book. I mean, so much of his conception of the book was, you know, all the billboards are online. I can just do this from my home. I can get all the rolling. I have the entire archive of Rolling Stones. I have all the billboards. I don't need to talk to anybody. I can just look at these magazines, convert it into a narrative. And, you know, he was trying to cut corners. And I think he produced a brilliant pair of books, especially part one. But that being said, you know, his expectations for this were so enormous. And then he talked the publisher into two books and got him to pay him more money. And then, you know, was very embittered when they didn't respond by putting even more money into it to market it. And he was expecting them to market it the way that the Rolling Stone book had been marketed in the 80s, you know, which is not the 80s. So it's a totally different environment. And he was great on the podcast, but then trying to get him to help me promote it was basically impossible, you know, and the window I had into his relationships with his peers was really interesting. You know, like he was, when I interviewed Robert Christgau for the show, he was really worried that Christgau, did he say anything about me? And, you know, and I was like, yeah, he had nice things to say about you when we talked backstage. And then I found out, you know, Ed thought that Christgau had trashed him in one of Christgau's books. And I got my hands on the book and went through the whole thing and found the one reference to Ed that was in no way defamatory towards Ed whatsoever. It was just saying that Ed was in over his head at Rolling Stone, which considering his tenure at Rolling Stone supposedly ended with him taking a broom to Jan Winter. I mean, yeah, he wasn't over his head at Rolling Stone. Who wouldn't be? And, you know, but he took that as this deep, grievous insult from Christgau, and it was just really sad, you know, and the last couple of years of him struggling and painting himself into these corners, like quitting NPR when I don't believe he needed to. I mean, they were promoting that book on every episode he appeared on.
And that was the biggest shot in the foot of them all. And
oh yeah,
the thing is, you know, that's real estate. And okay, I guess somewhere shortly after he returned from France, that came up and you know, hey, you know, take your radio scripts, stretch them out, and you've got a book right there. I mean, and you've got this platform. Fresh Air sells, as far as radio goes, sells books like no other program. And here he is with this, you know, these occasional things. And no matter how bad the diss or the oversight was on their part, he was looking for a fight. And it was always Terry hates me. And, you know, I heard that her personal piece at the end. I didn't hear the hate there. There might have been some defensiveness, but I do think he had some dust ups with a producer, and that may go back to his Berlin and France days when he was doing reports and they didn't always link up the way they were supposed to. He was late in delivering copy and some of these things. And all I know is, of all the things, if you want to say, you know, people hate me, or you know, they don't like me, or having a misconception, that Fresh Air thing was fatal, because you can't sell that book all of a sudden. And that's what cost him Volume 3 with the publisher. They would have rolled again if this was still Fresh Air and just getting mentioned all this time.
And yeah. His issue was that they wouldn't interview him, right?
They wouldn't give him a featured interview like he had once before, where they set him down and he was the star of the show for one episode, which I can understand being a little, you know, butthurt about that. And especially if you have a 30-year relationship, but he cut off his nose to spite his face in just the most egregious way there. And it was really sad to watch. And then to watch him paint himself into a corner. I tried to hook him up with some online writing gigs, and he was just so dead set on, well, this is my rate from the 90s, or, you know, just, he was not moving with the times, you know.
He lost the will to work. Yeah. Your story, I've heard from several other sources, and yet to talk to him, I've only made $1,000 this year, or I haven't made $1,000 this year. And that was for 2 years. And it was like, you know, are you bragging? You know, what's the deal here? But he clearly put it all on the books, and that's dangerous. I mean, the book industry ain't much of an industry. And unless you're really, really lucky, and you know, you break through in a big way, it doesn't pay the bills.
I think his books suffered simply because their time, the subject matter, their time had passed, and there's a whole new generation of book publishers, book readers that just really didn't care about that music. They have their own music now. And I see that, you know, in just looking at the coverage of entertainment, stuff from that period is interesting to older folk such as me. But a 20-something really doesn't care.
And the fifth, that's is particularly true about the 50s stuff that he was such a specialist in. And if he had wanted to do a book about that, he should have done that in the 90s when all those Elvis fans were still alive. But, you know, I mean, I'm glad he did the book. It's a great book. It's going to stand the test of time. But, you know, from a business perspective, yeah, why didn't he stretch out the Fresh Air? And I feel bad. I feel like we're knocking on Ed and his gifts. And it's just, there's a little bit of PTSD here for people who loved him and cared about him and tried to help him. And, you know, it was a pretty recalcitrant mule you're trying to lead through the pasture there. But, you know, and he recognized that. He was like, I should have written more about the Beatles and the Stones in the first book, because, you know, the Elvis fans are dead, too dead to buy books. And, you know, and so he recalibrated. But by that time, he had lost the NPR deal and you know, just had no concept of how to promote it. And, you know, I mean, a podcast is great, but it's without a vehicle, without some kind of media relationship. The days of, there was an era when a podcast could be an independent thing that was promoted, that promoted itself, but that ended by the time, you know, by 2015 or 2016. And ever since Serial. Yeah, it's been big business, and it's big media that controls that stuff. And you know, it was sad and frustrating to watch him paint himself into corners. And
Just to shift gears a little bit, what was Ed's role with South by Southwest?
Well, you'd have to go ask that inner circle. There were four founding directors: Louis J. Myers, Nick Barbaro, Louis Black, and Roland Swenson. But there was kind of a brain crust beyond those four, and Ed was one of those first or second go-to people, because this was a music conference and Ed knew the business, he knew people, and especially when they started going overseas and expanding, you know, he had European connections, he had a lot of connections. So Roland said a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't, you know, he said he was a founder of South by Southwest, and you know, I didn't know that his position was that I only knew those four were the directors, but Ed was right in there. And so he was a constant at South by Southwest. That's where I have to kind of measure. If I didn't see him for the rest of the year, it was like, you know, you're in Berlin or you're in France. I saw him at South by Southwest every year. It's like nothing much changed. Yeah, I had some things going, and you know, we'd always talk about stuff and maybe go do something together, but it wasn't like he'd been gone a long time. But he was very instrumental in basically giving the lay of the land of the business of music as far as the directors of South by Southwest, and explained to that how they could engage them, and then, you know, help them expand beyond the vision, beyond alternative newspapers in the United States, to become a global event. And certainly with his connections in Europe, you know, he'd go over to MeetIM with them every, I don't know if it was every MeetIM, but that's the largest music convention in the world, in Cannes, France, and Roland would go there. And Ed attended that frequently. So he had a very, he had a close position and an important position. And I don't know why it didn't end well, but it didn't end well.
Well, he became very critical of the conference and particularly the music that they were programming. I know in the last few years of any time we discussed music at South, I'm not going near that, the place, the music is all crap, you know? So he wasn't really fond of contemporary music and the kind of music that they were programming. And I think that might've been part of it.
He didn't go out. He hated music and he hated crowds. That since he returned back from France, that's all I heard. I don't go out anymore. I hate crowds. Or, you know, I hate music. I don't want to go out and hear music. And at every South by Southwest softball game championship, which is really the official end of South by Southwest, Sunday afternoons, and it's when you see all the directors of South by Southwest, Ed was there, and we'd always hang out and talk, but he was always dissing the, you know, what he had just experienced in front of Nick and Lewis and Roland. And I just thought, you know, talk about the bite the hand you feed you. I mean, to what benefit is this?
I don't think he really realized how people might take that. I mean, he just...
He wasn't capable.
It was just Ed, you know?
He didn't have that perspective. And he was also not capable of aligning his business interests over here and his critical preferences over there, you know?
And that's where I mean, he was a pure critic. That's how I basically settled all this in my head.
Yeah, he absolutely couldn't separate that. And yeah, I mean, being in on the ground floor of Rolling Stone, being in on the ground floor of Cream, or not quite the ground floor of Cream, but being around for that, being in on the ground floor of South By and walking away with essentially nothing except this body of work that stands the test of time, because he was so principled, because he did care about what he wrote and he did believe in what he wrote, and it comes through in the writing. So it's a trade-off. I mean, he could have been this careerist hack and we wouldn't be talking about him right now. It's just the paradox.
No, he wasn't that. But I also think it was this distinctive character, like no one else I've come close to meeting or knowing, you know, that part sticks out with me. And it's, and look, if I criticize it all, it's out of love. It's the frustration of not necessarily for all these years I've known him to be able to get through on certain things. But, you know, I look back and that's a life lived, and who am I to judge? And it's like, you know, so he was sloppy. And there's just many times when I look back, he makes me laugh, just being who he was. And that's in a good way. I'm not laughing at him. I'm really laughing with him at the ridiculousness of it all. But, you know, he didn't fit in. And to me, that was something that I think I admired in the music writers in general weren't generally conformists. That's what publicists were. And these were people that their opinion were supposed to matter. Their voice was supposed to matter. And really looking at this art form, music, what they thought was supposed to matter. And pre-internet, you either had to go to the record store and go to the listening room. If a single or an album was open, you could hear it. Or you had to hear it on the radio, or a friend had to turn you on to it. That was it. And today, you know, there's so many ways you hear, just see the name of a new piece of music. You can go hear it one way or another and make your own decision. But gatekeepers like Ed and that generation of music writers were really critical to boosting music as this kind of attachment to the culture and to being something more than a confection. But today, I don't think, you know, there's no critic that I jump out and read. I read Michael Corcoran sometimes just to see what he says, but he's back in the 1930s and 20s now.
So I just read Mojo.
Yeah.
See, I don't even read Mojo.
That's retro.
Not real incisive, but you know, I mean, I learn about a lot of good music there, and they also write about, you know, older stuff that I was into. Pretty good publication, but it's nothing like, you know, Crawdaddy was, or it may be closer to Crawdaddy than something like Rolling Stone. It's kind of funny to see that Rolling Stone and South by Southwest are now connected. They're now sort of like owned by the same growing conglomerate.
Oh yeah, the Penske Media Group.
Yeah,
that's kind of more of the end of Austin. My ATX book ended way too early.
Ed's interest in technology, which is one of the things that he and I really connected on. You know, we got to know each other and got to be friends and started meeting every year at South by Southwest when he would come in from France or Germany. And that's when we started having breakfast together, you know, every year. And that turned into a big thing where we invited a ton of people to breakfast. And the character of those breakfasts was that I was inviting people I knew from Interactive, from the technology side, and he was inviting people he knew from the music side. And we were, you know, kind of giving them an opportunity to connect and have conversations. And that was something I think he was into that. And he was kind of excited about the internet in a way. We once tried to put together a business called Swamp Dog. And what we were going to do is we were going to create a site where Ed would write about music, specifically music of the South and Southwest. And we would also like sell stuff online. We might sell Cajun spices or whatever. We had a lot of funny ideas about what we would do with that thing. But he got really excited about that project and the idea of having, you know, having this website that would just kind of be our thing. But we didn't get anywhere with it, unfortunately.
You hosted this blog for how many years?
Well, really, I'm not really. I helped him with it. It's always been on Blogger. So it's been hosted there. And I actually still have access to the latest version of his blog. But he just started out doing it on Blogger. We had, you know, I would help him with that and help him understand the web. And in one of those early breakfasts, I showed Nate, I had a picture of this the other day. It was Howard Rheingold, Nate, Ed, and I. hanging out and talking. And Howard Rheingold and I were really influencing Ed to get more active on the well. He had an account on the well, but he wasn't doing a whole lot with it. And he eventually became a very vocal citizen of the web, with the well, which is an online community that we were both part of. And in fact, people on the well were the most devastated by the news of his death. It was a terrible thing there. He had a lot of great relationships there and really spent a lot of time on there talking about all sorts of things. Obviously, I mean, the two things he liked to talk about, music was one, food was the other. I think he'd rather talk about food than music, though, really.
Yeah, by the end, he was really bitter about music. The thing about Ed and the internet was he was way sharper than I was about seeing what the pitfalls were going to be of this medium. And I was still an advocate for it and rah, rah, and well, this isn't going to work anymore, but this new thing is going to be different and make up for the difference. And Ed saw a lot of these things coming. He recognized that people listening to music and headphones is not building a community, that it's not, you know, that there's a real problem with that. And I was really late to recognize that. He recognized that there were going to be a handful of companies that were able to control all these bottlenecks way before I did, you know, and, you know, I was dismissing him as a curmudgeon about a lot of things when he was actually a very astute observer. And I think one thing that separates him, I think, you know, Grail Marcus is a great writer and Chris Gell kept up with all the new music and has been very insightful. And Lester Bangs was the great personality and kind of the philosopher king of punk rock. But what Ed was able to do, none of those, I don't think any of his peers was able to do, was look at the music in the context of the culture, look at the technology, the sociology, and the business and how that interacted with the music and put that into a context and a narrative that gave it a lot more richness and depth. I think I know I've been able to look at all kinds of music. I mean, you know, Ed didn't like Billie Holiday, which really, like, who doesn't like Billie Holiday? Like, you know, like, and I didn't want to hear why. As soon as he said, I don't like Billie Holiday, I was just like, just stop there. That's all I need to know. You know, like, I don't want to talk to somebody who doesn't like Billie Holiday about Billie Holiday, but I can apply his methods to studying the jazz of that era. I can apply his methods to studying the hard rock of the early 70s that he had no use for. Like, he admitted to me he had never listened to a Led Zeppelin record until he was working on volume 2 of his book, you know, which, you know, as a Gen Xer who got that stuff with Mama's Milk, I was like, no wonder you assholes were all so wrong about this stuff. You didn't even give it a chance. But at the same time, he was seeing Jimmy Page and Peter Grant and those guys tooling around in these giant limos, and he knew exactly how little money Howlin' Wolf had, you know, and was offended by the grossness of that spectacle. And I can understand why he opted out of it. But anyway, that ability of him, of his, to identify these are the symptoms of a scene that is likely to go beyond its little region. And it's always regional. Every great music scene, you know, has a regional base. That's another thing he taught me, you know. But, and then he taught me, you know, look for these trends, new technologies, you know, ethnic groups or some kind of outsider group. He just gave me a whole recipe. Here's how you spot a scene that's going to matter. And I think sometimes he used that. I think he misread some scenes because he was looking for it to perfectly fit his template. But at the same time, out of all his peers, he's the only one who had that kind of sociological depth to his analysis. And it's a real contribution.
I think you point out one of his really strong character traits. He was helpful to people that he got, you know, that he believed in, I guess. You know, if he didn't like you, you were out of luck. But I have to personally, you know, look to him as having been a mentor when I changed from politics to music. And, you know, I was helping him out. I had a car and I was going to all the shows. But he gave me so much insight on what was really going on in the music business, who to look to and who to avoid, you know, what was really causing certain types of music to be popular. And he gave me a lot of insight on what publicity was all about and what publicists to avoid. So he was a great guide to the world of music. And he's did that for a lot of people. When I wrote what I wrote in Facebook when I found out he was gone, and I pointed out the things that he had helped me with, and I got a lot of feedback from people said, yeah, he did that for me. He helped me on my project. He gave me good advice. And so that was his strong point, I believe, is, you know, if he wanted to, he could really help you out.
Yeah, he knew that I was crazy about this psychedelic band from the late 60s called Auto Salvage, which a lot of people haven't ever heard of because they only really released one album. But I thought that it was one of the greatest albums I'd ever heard. It's a really great rock and roll album. And Ed and I had talked about it before. He knew I was into those guys. He somehow connected with them, and they wanted to have a reunion at South by Southwest and come and play. And he helped them get in. And then he came to me and said, hey, I know you love this band. They're coming. I'll introduce you to them. You can come see them play at South by while we're there. It was like dream come true, right? I got to not just meet these guys who were sort of like mythical to me, but I got to spend some time with them, you know, hang out with them a bit. And that never would have happened if it wasn't for Ed. They never would have been here if it wasn't for Ed. He helped them get in because he knew that they wanted to take one last round in front of an audience, I guess.
Yeah, so multiply that by thousands of times. I mean, yeah. He did that over and over and over again. He was an incredibly helpful, generous, and wise person. And I'm just really grateful I got to spend the time I did with him and learn the things I did from him. And I'm glad he's not struggling anymore.
Yeah. You know, the last thing he and I talked about was kind of on a list we're on. I mentioned that there's this wine that I wanted to get that you could only get in Northern California. And his response was road trip. He was ready to go. I thought we were going to end up meeting in California and buying cases of this wine.
Maybe in another life.
Yeah. Well, any closing remarks? We've been talking for close to an hour.
Well, you know, the problems he had, yeah, we all have problems. But if you look at the personal lives of a lot of, you know, great influential people, there are no angels out there. Everyone has their quirks. Everyone has their character flaws. I certainly do, and I'm not going to lie to you. Ed had his, but he also had something about just who he was that overcomes all of those things that we've talked about, you know, and that's why so many people really still miss him. It's been a few weeks, but it still hurts just as much.
Yeah, I think one thing, like, you know, we've talked a lot about how Ed couldn't adapt to this set of changes in the media world, but keep in mind he adapted to so many changes over the course of his career that everybody runs out of steam at the end, and he had a great long run. I mean, you know, he was there at the beginning of the rock critic boom scene and jumped from Rolling Stone to Cream and made it to the Statesman, helped develop the scene here with South by Southwest. And then I wish I knew more about what he had been up to in Berlin and that had come to fruition, because he had his finger on the pulse. He knew that that was one of the places in the world where some of the most innovative, exciting music going on was happening. He's the only one of his generation that was into that stuff and prescient enough to see it at the time. I mean, Chris Gow's had some other scenes that he's been hip to, but none of their peers kept up and adapted the way that Ed, you know, was at least showing the potential to. And the stuff he was working on never came to fruition in Berlin, but, you know, hats off. I really honored that I got to work with him when I did and learn from him. And total amateur doing it as a hobby, you know, and just a coincidence that I was able to sit down with him and have those conversations. And it's something I'll always treasure.
You got to love somebody who'll chase Jan Winter with a broom.
Yeah, I wish I could.
Joe, Nick, you got anything else?
No, I miss him. He was a good friend. One of a kind. like no one else. That's for damn sure.
Well, I think if he had been able to hear what we've been saying, he probably would have approved even the negative parts of his character, because he really hated people who only threw softballs. Yeah, he liked hard pitchers.
I would accept at least a couple "no, you're wrongs" somewhere along the way, or to be corrected or steered. But you know, if there's legacies are weird things to even talk about. And I always think in terms of when you get older, you start thinking, yeah, well, what's a legacy worth? Is it worth 10 years after you're gone? You know, 100 years? Or how does time go? This isn't Socrates' time, I don't think. But he has left behind, Ed Ward has left behind quite a body of work. And it tells us a lot about our times and our culture, as well as what he was writing about. And, you know, that's, for a writer, I don't think you can wish for anything more than that. He achieved those things. I'm sorry, and really full of regret that he didn't get a chance to completely enjoy the spoils without some of the things that he had to face late in life. And but, you know, late in life isn't always pretty.
Well, thanks, everybody. I think this has been quite a conversation.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. That was great. Yeah.
And we will see you all soon somewhere.
Somewhere down the road.
Somewhere down the road. At Giddy thanks, Ups, Ed. Probably. Adios.
Bye, Ed.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.